From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a ghost story in the journalist Stephen Volk's family, and even though you can find it in his book, he hates telling it. He used to love the story when he was a kid because he was there. He was young, but he heard things and he saw things. When he was older, he stopped telling it because, as he explains, the believers with their unblinking acceptance and the skeptics with their smug scorn left him cold. Volk's book explores the paranormal, not just ghost stories, but telepathy and near-death experiences and UFOs. He evaluates the science and the evidence and along the way makes a case for a middle space in between credulity and repudiation. Volk says the paranormal raises important questions about what and why we believe and why it's okay to just concede the mystery. Please join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Stephen Volk has written a book about his efforts to explain away the unexplainable. Volk wanted to take on the paranormal, psychics and ghost stories and near-death experiences and UFOs. And he wasn't out to necessarily debunk these things, but try and understand what we know about them and what we don't. His book explores the paranormal, not just ghost stories, but other things. And he evaluates the science, the evidence. Along the way, he makes an argument for a kind of middle space in between credulity and repudiation. Volk says the paranormal raises important questions about what and why we believe. His book is called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. And Steve Volk is joining us today to talk about it. Steve Volk is a senior writer at Philadelphia Magazine. He's also written for Rolling Stone, The New Republic, and Men's Journal, among others. Fringeology is his first book, and he's joining us today from a studio at Temple University in Philadelphia. And Steve Volk, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to begin with when you were contemplating this book, what sort of a risk did you figure you were taking for your reputation? I mean, how did you, as you were thinking about it, what did you figure were going to be the risks? And was there ever a moment, this is the thing I was interested in, when you thought, you know, maybe I shouldn't do this?
There were actually many such moments. And there was a period of time after I first signed the contract with HarperCollins. For about 6 months, I would wake up one or two nights a week around 3 a.m. thinking that I had just destroyed my entire career, my entire life. And truly in an absolute panic and terror. And funnily enough, some of the research I ended up doing for the book helped me to deal with that anxiety and to realize where that was sort of really coming from and how to handle it. But I would get the thing that most upset me, I suppose, is when a fellow journalist at the Pen and Pencil Club, oldest press club in America, where I'm on the board, I would get into conversations with fellow reporters there and they'd say, "So what's this book you're writing?" And I tell them, "Well, you know, I pick up from an old family ghost story I grew up with as a kid." And they're like, "A legend?" I'm like, "No, not a legend. You know, something I have memories of myself." Yeah. And you know, it's a really, really weird story. And they would give me what I would call the second head look, where they would look at me like suddenly I had sprouted a second head. Yeah. And I think unconsciously, they themselves would look me up and down. They would look from my shoes back up to my head, and it was like they were completely reappraising me. So I had a lot of moments of thinking, man, oh man, I have made a mistake here.
You know, if you think about it, we'll talk about the terms as we go, but skeptics and believers, let me just put it that in simplistic terms here just for just a moment. But they're both, right. And the book is about this, about the things that they actually share, which seems almost in some ways more than the things they don't. But as I said, we'll get into that. But they're both terrifically vociferous and really vocal. And I'm wondering what kind of reaction you expected, and just give us a sense of what kind of reaction you're now getting. Because you can be critical, for example, of the skeptical community in some ways, as well as raising questions on the other side. But are you getting a pretty strong reaction, I guess?
I am, and I think that for the most part, believers are comfortable with the book and like the book. And I think it's because here's a guy from the mainstream saying, hey, look, you know, something's going on here, and it's too easy and it's inaccurate to dismiss it as superstition. It isn't simply wanting to believe that is causing people to believe in paranormal things. It's, you know, direct experience of stuff. In the case of telepathy, there's mountains of research to support some sort of small form of telepathy. There's a lot more to this than the skeptics would ordinarily have us believe. I've received a couple of invitations from skeptics to come speak. I haven't done that yet, although I intend to follow up and do so. I think skeptics maybe don't know what to make of me.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, I bash them pretty good in the book, but on the other, it's not like I'm coming out and saying, hey, look, you know, ghosts are definitely representatives, emissaries, you know, from the afterlife, you know, which is the sort of thing they're used to getting from, quote, believers.
Yeah.
I am somewhere in this middle space.
Well, it's interesting. This seems like the kind of reaction you would get when you were a younger and you would tell this family ghost story, which you've confessed you kind of hate telling the story, and I may push you on that a little bit as we go. But you said that over time you just stopped telling it because you'd get two particular kinds of responses. From the believers who heard the story, you say they would react to it sort of in an unquestioned way, and that left you kind of feeling cold.
And can I interrupt there?
Yeah.
Even worse than just the unblinking acceptance was when they would start to explain to me the hierarchies of the afterlife.
Right.
And exactly what kind of spirit must have been in our house and, you know, how to interact with these things in the future. And, you know, here I was thinking this was all very mysterious, and they would act like they had it wired. You know, the whole afterlife, they get it. They know how angels and demons and all this stuff, you know, interacts with our world.
But then, of course, the skeptics who would hear your story, you know, they'd sort of dismiss it out of hand, which also left you cold because they had the same kind of smug reaction. It seems like that's the thing you're reacting to. And I think you even say in the book, in some ways you're making a case not just for the middle space, but for a kind of humility.
Yeah, I think that it was the anger of the skeptics that really surprised me. They would be downright angry with me for saying, no, it's really unexplained. I mean, and I don't mind. I mean, I'll tell the story. I've told the story on radio plenty of times.
I would
relate the story to them, and I would, and I would tell them that I think it's truly unexplained, and they could not tolerate that. And to them, it had to be, say, the water pipes, even though the water pipes just they don't fit. You have to toss out too much testimony from the people there to make it fit. And my thing is, well, you know what? When you have a story like that, the only thing we can say is we don't really know what went on. And nobody wins.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they don't like. You know, no, I guess nobody likes a tie.
Yeah. You know, it's. I guess we have to define what paranormal means, because I think some get a sense that you're talking about something that is beyond the reach of science. But you don't disconnect those, though.
No, I think that something paranormal is something that exists beyond what science has explained to date.
Yeah.
And, you know, science, it's pretty powerful. And it generally tracks down its prey and kills it, you know. And so over time, I would expect that, you know, many, maybe most or all of these things will ultimately find some sort of scientific explanation. But that doesn't, to me... I mean, that doesn't mean telepathy doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Telepathy may exist, and at some point, science will figure out how. I think for skeptics, it's sort of synonymous with, well, what science will explain is sort of, you know, how people have deceived themselves into thinking these things exist. The other day, I was in the bookstore, and there was another book out by a sociologist looking at the paranormal, in which the subhead was something about understanding people's deviant beliefs.
Hmm.
And I thought to myself, gosh, you know, that's just so crazy. That's a deviant belief to have written that line. The fact is, when you look at polls on the subject, you know, 20% of us believe we've had direct experience of a ghost. The numbers are higher for UFOs. For telepathy, it's generally, depending on the poll, somewhere between 40 and 50% of us believe we've had some sort of direct psychic experience. Not just where we had a reading from a psychic, but we picked up information somehow ourselves that turned out to be real. That's not deviancy within society. That's the norm.
We'll get into more detail about this as we go, but what do you figure, Steve Volk, was the takeaway for you about human nature? I mean, what did you learn about the way, as you put it in the book, we frame these conflicting worldviews? We tend to go to extremes, I guess.
Right, and we commit to a worldview. Yeah. We find a way of looking at the world that works for us, that helps us negotiate the various decisions we have to make day in, day out, that presents us with some understanding of who we are in that deep existential sense on this planet. And once we're comfortable with that, we defend it. And anything that comes up that contradicts that view is immediately subject to an emotional, visceral reaction. And if you look at studies on the subject, it's a true visceral reaction. Your amygdala lights up, your palms sweat, you get tense, that fight or flight response kicks in. And that's why there's such a chasm, I think, between believers and skeptics, and it's so hard to talk about these things in any sort of truly rational way.
Are some of us inclined to believe and some of us inclined to be skeptics? Do we understand what might spark a sense of skepticism in a person or what might make a person a believer throughout their life?
Great, great question. And there's been a lot of research done by academics on what makes a believer. But there's been almost no research, in fact, to date, I mean, no real research on what makes a skeptic a skeptic. Hmm. And it's funny because I actually bulldog a skeptic in the pages of the book in Fringeology, and I ask him about that. And he admits that this is a sign of bias on the part of academics and academia, that they don't feel that they need to be studied as skeptics, but believers do. Those are the ones you pin under your microscope. So we don't know exactly what makes a skeptic yet, and hopefully at some point we will, because I think that we'll find that they are operating out of need to some degree, particularly when they become this sort of arch skeptic, where that's partly how they identify themselves as, oh, I'm a skeptic.
There's this subclass of Americans you identify as embarrassed Americans. And I wonder, do you yourself wonder just how many unexplained stories there are out there, but that have been, you know, kind of secreted away by people because they're just too reticent to say anything about it because they're afraid of the way people may react?
I've done at least a dozen public appearances, and I've had at least three people come up to me after every one to tell me a story that they didn't share during my event. Because part of my event, I try and draw people out and I say to them, hey, if you want to tell a story during the Q&A session, please do, you know, because that's partly what the book's about for me, is sort of removing the stigma from these subjects. So just, you know, based on my own survey, I mean, you know, I've had anywhere from 10 to 100 people at my readings. And, you know, it's got to be at least 10% of the population, at least, is carrying around stories that they don't share at all.
You say this book is both public but also personal. There's this kind of mixture here. And it's interesting, your perspective as a journalist, Steve Volk, that you can't be completely dispassionate, because I won't say that the family ghost story anchors the book necessarily, but it certainly gets you started on a kind of line of inquiry in some ways. I mean, it's not a memoir, but it is really personal. It's interesting that mix you came to.
Yeah, you know, I've come to realize since I've written the book and since I've been talking about it a lot, that really the death of my mother is where it all started for me in terms of deciding to go ahead and research this and write a book. And I talk at some length about the death of my mom in Fringeology. And I think it's only natural when you lose someone like that to start to wonder about the exact nature of who we are. You know, will you ever see her again? That kind of thing. And so with that story in my background, that was obviously the first thread to go ahead and kind of pick up and start a search.
So in the end, we just don't have the final answers to those most important questions of humankind. I mean, you know, those deeply existential ones. What, you know, what happens when you die? Is there a God? You know, why are we here? And I guess you're saying is, look, we'll never know those. And so there's nothing wrong with having a kind of – you're arguing for the mystery. Let's just accept the fact that that is a mystery, and it may be –
I think that we can, I mean, I think someday we may know the answers to these things, but I think that empirically, those are hard questions to test. And at the moment, we need to accept that there is mystery here. And I think there's a freedom within that. I mean, within that, we get to believe what really speaks to us, you know, what we really believe is true. We just need to remember that we don't know, you know, and I think we equate belief and knowledge all the time. And, you know, you see it play out in our politics a lot, you know, people going off their beliefs, acting like they're facts. And it spoils our politics. And I think it spoils our conversations about really the most important topics. I mean, are we alone in the universe? Is there a God? What happens, if anything, when we die? What's it mean to be human? And I think that the best route we can take is to enter into this conversation with a little bit of humility. Mm. And whatever our beliefs might be on the subject, be curious about what other people believe and why they believe that, and sifting through whatever information that they have.
Yeah, because you are saying, too, that we may at some point know if there is a God, or we may know why we're here in some way. We may have a sense of what happens when you die. And I guess it's an argument for, as you say in the book, not a critique of science. You're saying, let's have more of it.
Yeah, let's have more of it. And I think that one of the things that frustrates me about the skeptical community is that they so often criticize people merely for studying these subjects in a truly open-minded fashion, rather than studying it in terms of the psychology of those foolish believers. You know, that part's the only one they seem to think is truly valid.
You know, we had a conversation a couple weeks ago, maybe more than a month ago, with a professor at Idaho State University, Jeff Meldrum.
Yeah, the Bigfoot guy,
yeah. And we weren't necessarily doing the story about whether or not Bigfoot exists. I mean, we were, I think, more interested in the fact that there was a man who was a believer. I mean, but it was interesting the reaction we got. It was pretty strong, completely dismissive. And I guess, they may be right. I mean, they may be completely right. But just the fact that we had brought up the subject at all, they were completely opposed to. And I'm guessing you're finding that as well.
At times. I mean, I think that, you know, certainly in the public appearances, people are really grateful that somebody is out there saying, hey, wait a second. You know, again, if you look at polls on the subject, the paranormal is normal. People believe that they have encountered these things. And given that, we should be able to talk about it rationally. And given that we don't have the ultimate answers to the big existential questions, we should enter into that conversation with a little humility. I think that's a humble enough stance, too, that, you know, maybe I haven't drawn as much fire as I otherwise might. But, it's interesting to me to hear you say that, because, I mean, Jeff Meldrum, he's a specialist in his field. He has some outlandish, you know, sorts of things to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, I stayed away from Bigfoot, actually, in fringeology, because I sort of didn't want to go there. It's funny. I mean, as tainted as the subjects I took on are, I felt like, well, Bigfoot's just a bridge too far.
Wait, you did UFOs and you figured Bigfoot was a bridge too far.
Yeah. And, I, you know, the other thing about Bigfoot is I don't think it speaks to any of those big existential mysteries in the same way that UFOs do. You know, are we alone in the universe?
Right.
So that was the other reason I was able to sort of justify pushing past it. But, you know, people lose sight, too. I mean, I had explored that topic a little bit, and it relates back to fringeology. So let me, you know, get into this for a second.
Yeah.
If you look at the people who don't wind up on TV on Bigfoot hunting shows, and you look at the people like Jeff Meldrum, you look at the people who run a website called Cryptomundo.
Yeah.
They don't believe that there is a supernatural creature stalking through the woods. That's the furthest thing from their minds. They believe there is some kind of ape that has a very small population that is occasionally seen or glimpsed. And I have, again, no dog in that hunt.
Yeah.
But they're not making a claim for a supernatural creator. They're not making a claim for the ability of one human being to telepathically send information to another one, you know, across the country. They're arguing there might be an ape we're not aware of yet. And And yet it provokes so much emotion from people because they have this vision of the world, and their vision of the world doesn't include room for that. And I find that itself, you know, educational.
Steve Volk, his book is called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Steve Volk is with us to talk about his book, Fringeology. Volk is taking on the paranormal, looking at ghost stories and stories about psychics and UFOs, things like that. The book is an argument not for believing these things or for discounting them, but for a middle space where the weird and compelling can raise important questions. The book is full of, Steve Volk, these really compelling stories of people who are really courageous in many ways. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is one of those that you tell. Talk about her story. Of course, she was the writer of that definitive book on death and dying. And her her story, I have to say, is surprising. I hadn't realized some of the elements about this.
Yeah, it doesn't get a lot of play because when people remember her or write about her now, they generally are focused on the book on death and dying, in which she had really been the first person to work closely with the terminally ill as they were dying and to catalog what their feelings were and what their interactions with their family members were like and how we might better care for them. Mm-hmm. And it's the book that triggered the international hospice movement. So in terms of great books in history, it's way up on the list. The world is literally a different place because she wrote that book. What people don't know is, or not a lot of people know, is that while she was researching that work, she was hearing stories that she didn't know how to catalog. Mm. She was hearing, this is back in the 60s, mid-60s. She's hearing stories from people about, let's say they were resuscitated and they had, you know, recovered. And they would tell her, you know, I left my body. I saw a white light. I saw deceased loved ones. I had this tremendous feeling of peace. These people who reported these sorts of experiences were dealing with their terminal prognosis a lot better than the people who had not had this sort of experience. She was hearing stories from people about seeing deceased loved ones in their rooms. Mm. And they seemed to be different than hallucinations, because in a hallucination, the people truly could not interact. The patients could not interact with the other people in the room anymore. They didn't seem to be in touch with the objective, verifiable reality around them. They were instead caught up in a hallucination. But these people who seemed to be having what she started calling deathbed visitations or visions were able to interact equally with the person or thing they claimed to be seeing. Mm. And the hospital workers in their room or relatives in their room. And so she'd collected she heard some of these stories and discounted them. But when she started hearing them repeatedly, she started taking notes on them. Yeah. Just the way she took notes on everything else that the dying were telling her. And by the time she got around to writing on death and dying, it would have been around 1968. The book came out in 69. She had enough of this material that she, in fact, included in her original manuscript for On Death and Dying an entire chapter on near-death experiences. This is before anybody had coined that phrase, and so she didn't call them near-death experiences.
Yeah.
And deathbed visitations. And her research partner talked her out of including it for the reasons that we were discussing in the first segment. It would hurt her credibility, yeah, to say the least, and it would keep the very real people who needed their help, the terminally ill, from getting the help that they needed. And so she buried that chapter. But it's remarkable because what's happened since, right, is there's this sense the skeptics give that when they write about Kubler-Ross, that she did this research and she wrote on death and dying, and then at some point she kind of went off the rails.
Right.
But the fact is, while she was clear-eyed and lucid enough to diagnose the way in which all of Western medicine was mistreating the terminally ill by not even telling patients that they were terminally ill, it was seen as somehow too awful to tell them the truth, so they would try and keep them in the dark about their condition. At the same time that she was lucid enough to diagnose everyone in that situation, she was also becoming convinced by the stories she was hearing from patient after patient that something worth studying was happening in the near-death experience and the deathbed visitation. And if I may go on for another beat longer.
Of course.
Time has proven her right, okay? I mean, if you look back now 40 years later, everyone would agree that the near-death experience exists. It's a subject of wide, wide study. Of course, the question is, what is the nature of it, right? What produces it?
Right.
And that's a continuing debate. But she felt she couldn't even relate these experiences at all because the taboo was so heavy on her and or on that subject. So to me, that shows like how dysfunctional our relationship is to any subject that might have some of that paranormal taint about it. She couldn't even go public with it.
Yeah. It's interesting, about 6 or 7 years later, 1975, I think it was, she does sort of go all in, or at least in part, when she writes this foreword to the book,
yep.
And
many
people may have heard of it, Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, which does deal with these near-death experiences. And as you say, she puts her reputation absolutely in jeopardy at that point.
Yeah, and she paid the price in a big, big way. And everything that happened to her afterward in the book I covered at length, I mean, she falls under the sway of a psychic who was really a charlatan. And she exists as a kind of a cautionary tale for anyone who's going to go all into the paranormal.
Yeah.
What motivated her to do that was the hit her reputation took for backing Raymond Moody's book angered her so much that she wanted to find some sort of irrefutable proof to wave in people's faces. And when she went out on that search, she got in trouble.
You talk about how in many ways it's a really powerful example of, as you say in the book, both skeptics and believers really seeing only what they want and expect to see. And this is a theme throughout the book, I have to say, that again, it may go back to our inherent ideas. We want to reconcile what we think. So all we're looking for is something to confirm it almost in some way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the near-death experience, from a believer's point of view, it offers more than hope, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it offers evidence. But the fact is, you know, we're dealing with subjective reports from individual people, and it is interesting that when you cross-reference them all, they agree in the main on a general set of parameters about what happens. But you can't really take it as, you know, firm evidence that the afterlife exists at this point. There are people who are trying to develop a study where if somebody does leave their body in the hospital, there will be these sort of random targets up near the ceiling that only they could see. And so if anybody reports one of those targets, now we'll have some sort of, you know, verifiable proof that someone left their body. We'll see if that produces anything. Me, I think if my body's dead on the table down below me, I'm not going to be looking at random targets up near the ceiling.
Right.
But that is just me. And then on the skeptical side, you know, they want to put it all down to brain function, but they've got a big, big, big problem, which is that nobody's ever been able to quantify how what's happening to the patient at the time produces predictable changes in the experience. So in other words, if you were taking a shower under an anesthetic or not under an anesthetic, you would report a very different experience of that shower, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, these differences don't make a difference, any sort of measurable difference, in the near-death experience. So you end up having to figure out, well, how somebody who was in an accident and suffering from blood loss or dying on an operating table or in the midst of a heart attack or had, in some cases, no brain function, you know, all the way down the line, end up reporting this similar experience when, in fact, if those things are happening to you, it's going to change the function of your brain, right?
Mm.
And yet that doesn't seem to come through in the stories people tell. And it's not to say that they won't ever figure it out, right? Maybe they will. But at the moment, I think it's very safe to say, and the most rational thing to say about the near-death experience is, we don't really understand it yet. And, you know, obviously there are probably some people really upset to hear me say that. But I think that that's what the evidence shows. We don't understand it yet.
Let's go to the phones. Don is with us. He's in Ogden. Don, welcome.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling up because you keep making statements that confuse me about what you're defining as knowledge. I think it's great, and I think most scientists agree that to say "I don't know" is a really great response to paranormal activity or any other thing. But I think when you say things like "someday we may know about God," then it starts sounding more like a faith-based experience rather than something that can be measured.
Well, to speak to that one directly, I mean, you raise a good point, and I've argued this on my blog, right, at stevevolk.com. Until we have a godometer, right, or a deoscope, I don't know that we'll ever really be able to claim that we know God, right, that know whether or not a God exists. And so if that's kind of where you're headed with this, I mean, I agree. I think it's unlikely that we're ever going to have that sort of instrument. But I think just as a point of principle, I just wanted to put it out there that I think ultimately, I mean, it's worth pursuing, right? Every question is worth pursuing scientifically.
Don, glad you called. And here's an email from Nick who writes, I'm enjoying the discussion and I appreciate Steve Volk's view, but I would argue when it comes to the paranormal, disbelief should be the default position. Bertrand Russell, he writes, articulated this brilliantly with his analogy of a teapot orbiting the sun. Our inability to disprove such a thing does not require us to take an ambiguous or neutral position on its existence. You want to respond to that?
Well, again, I think that belief is healthy and fine. Right. So I don't believe a teacup is orbiting the sun or the moon, for that matter. Let me go on the record with that. So I think that could be the default position if that's what he's advocating for. I think belief is fine. I'm just saying we have to remember we don't know. And in the case of a teacup orbiting the sun, there's not a lot at stake there. And maybe not so much worth studying. Right. Or holding to that view, remembering to say, like, you know, we don't know. But I think with these big existential questions that represent deeper mysteries, right, there aren't millions of people claiming to have direct experience of a teacup orbiting the sun. There are, however, millions of people claiming to have direct experience of some kind of higher power, right, however you want to phrase that or put that. And so we have to step back and ask ourselves a question. Isn't that then a more interesting claim, even from a scientific perspective? I would argue that it is, because there are all these people claiming the experience.
So let's talk about your experience with psychics. There's a chapter where you deal with the paranormal question of telepathy and those kinds of things. And you write about your experience with psychics, two in particular, because you said you've consulted them over the years. And the first one was kind of a street corner fortune teller, and it was a basic scam, I guess. But the other experience you write about was certainly more personal, and it made you come to a conclusion that it's, again, more complicated. Talk about that.
Well, yeah. I do think that, you know, if skeptics do any good in the world, it's making sure that people are on guard before they do something like consult a psychic. Yeah. Because, as you said in the first experience, clearly this woman was out to scam me. And I was well aware of it, and just by virtue of her actions. In the second case, I think we were dealing with something else, right? We're dealing with a person who truly believes, in this instance, that she has psychic ability, that she wasn't out to scam me. And there's a lot of evidence to support that. I don't need to go into it here. But there are a lot of people who believe they have this ability. And in the case with me, she had a tremendous run of hits related to a friend of mine who'd passed away. And it was enough to rock me, frankly, because, you know, she got his personality in I thought, a really you know, sort of deep and meaningful way. She got that I had spoken up for him after he died, that I gave some sort of talk about him. And, you know, I would have been a very unlikely person to do that because we knew each other and we liked each other. There was like warm feeling there, but we were by no means close. We'd only had a couple of real social interactions in our lives. And she got that it was surprising for me to talk about him, and the way I went about it was surprising for me. She just, and she nailed all this stuff, not through the typical sort of cold reading thing where you sort of fish. She's just like, and this, and this, and this, and this, in a steady stream, just knocking the targets down. And I didn't expect this at all. But on the other hand, she was so wrong and so vague and so general mm-hmm. with anything she had to say about my mother that I ended up concluding that, you know, that the absolute best, most charitable thing you could say about her was that maybe she had heard something from my friend, right? And it also convinced me that I'm not terribly interested in seeing more psychics because that was a very painful... it was a painful sort of experience, and other people may feel differently about it, and you know, have a psychic they trust, and you know, they want to go see. But for me, I thought, you know, I'd rather you know, later in the book I talk about meditation and prayer and lucid dreaming, and I'd rather engage in those sorts of things than put my trust in someone else. Now, that said, I think that the amount of research going on here should even be increased. I mean, there's a lot of data to suggest that some small form of telepathy actually exists.
But small form. I mean, that's another thing that you write about, that if there is such a thing, it doesn't have much impact. It's pretty weak.
Mm-hmm. Let me explain.
Yeah.
So you're talking there about situations like if somebody's trying to guess which of four cards is next going to come up, right? And they've got four target images. Over thousands of trials, people might be right 28% of the time, 29% of the time, or even as high as 32% of the time, when 25% would be expected by chance. So it's statistically robust, right? It would be considered scientifically significant. But in terms of John Edward standing up there, you know, on his old show Crossing Over, right, or the psychic that I, you know, called for my research for the book, just nailing fact after fact after fact, the research doesn't suggest that's happening, right? The research suggests that what we really have, or what we're really dealing with, is a very small form of telepathy that is in any one of us that allows us to be right a little more often than chance would suggest. And that would also explain why, you know, the evidence that's out there isn't ironclad, because it's a very ephemeral sort of ability, as Stephen LaBerge, one of the scientists I interview later in the book, calls it, a weak signal.
Steve Volk is with us. His book is called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with journalist Steve Volk. We're talking about his book, Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. Let's go back to the phones. Kurt is with us in Tooele, Utah. Kurt, welcome.
Hi. Great program, Doug. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment the marvels of science and the things that it reveals that we had just not anticipated and how that changes our worldview. My understanding is that physicists now are starting to lean toward this concept of string theory, and one of the real amazing concepts that theory is postulating is the idea of multiple universes, which could explain what's going on. Maybe there's a small leakage between these universes, and perhaps the idea of reincarnation would just mean going from one universe to the next and enable us to somehow communicate back on rare occasions.
Well, Steve Volk, again, the idea of the possible. There are a lot of options out there, I guess.
There are a lot of possibilities. I mean, one of the things I find really intriguing about current physics is that, for instance, this many worlds hypothesis, the theory goes that there isn't any leakage, right, in the current theory, that there wouldn't be any leakage between universes, that that wouldn't be possible, and that the, I don't want to put this, well, not in any, I should clarify that, not in any meaningful sense, yeah. Right? So not to explain anything we'd see or encounter sort of up here at our level of reality. But what's intriguing is that there's also no way as of yet to verify these other universes. And so and it's questionable as to whether or not we'd ever have that. And it puts us in the same position in terms of understanding reality, right, and understanding basic physics that we're in understanding whether or not a God exists. We lack a godometer. We lack a many-universometer.
Yeah.
And you know, people will point to this and say, well, isn't it interesting that, you know, that physics and theology sort of have something to share like this now? A lot of people who are heavily vested in science obviously find that offensive, but I do think there's something to it. The more we find out about reality, it does seem our grasp on it seems to loosen.
Kurt, thanks very much. Neil is with us in Provo, Utah. Neil, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I would like to know how you regard the miraculous in terms of paranormal phenomena, and maybe more particularly maybe the influence of angels. Have you done surveys that know how many people have had experiences, maybe personal encounters with angels or things like that, or with people who have the power of healing? I mean, I want to know how you regard the miraculous. I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
I regard it as possible. You know, I mean, I really do. I regard it as possible, and I've heard stories from people I trust that are, you know, frankly unbelievable. Edgar Mitchell, one of the guys I write about in the book, has a miracle story in his past where supposedly a healer at a distance healed him of a cancer. You know, you hear about these things. I actually have to say that I'm not against hope. You know, I'm pro hope. And I think that it's possible that there are things that can happen that we don't currently have a means of explaining. And so whenever I hear a story like that, you know, and I admit there's sometimes I hear these things and my immediate reaction is to laugh or pull away a bit. But I'm always pretty quick to remind myself to just sort of stand in there and listen instead, you know, with a real curious spirit. Because this stuff is fascinating. And in a journalistic sense, man, it's low-hanging fruit. You know, we're kind of missing we're missing the boat on stories that really do affect people and get people talking and allow us as journalists to start addressing, again, you know, these really big questions.
It raises the question for me. You tell the story about this academic psychologist named Charles Tart, who spoke at this conference you had gone to in Seattle.
Yeah.
And it raised the question, you know, he raises this idea about whether or not now we are these particular people are somehow believers in a God now. And what raises the question for me, what is the relationship between belief in the paranormal and belief in God? Because they don't, I mean, you would assume they were naturally connected, but it doesn't seem like they are.
No, and particularly among academics who are studying the paranormal from a sort of pro-paranormal side. They are deeply, deeply skeptical at best about the existence of a creator. I mean, there are exceptions, but like, you know, Edgar Mitchell, I mentioned before, doesn't believe in any kind of creator God at this point. At that telepathy conference in Seattle, when Charles Tart, who is a longtime parapsychologist working in the field since the 60s, he was accepting an award, as a matter of fact, during the speech. And when he said, you know, hey, we can't fool those skeptics anymore. They know we believe in God. A chill went across the room because according to my survey, which I actually quote in the book, the vast majority of them don't believe in God. And these are people who are studying telepathy. And if you look at the Baylor Religion Survey, too, there is not the kind of overlap that people would expect in terms of belief in, you know, some sort of organized religion and belief in the paranormal. And, you know, often it's the religious leaders who are trying to, you know, convince people that these things don't exist, or that if they do, you know, they're the product of the devil and you shouldn't pay attention to them.
You say in the book that the thing that rationalists and paranormalists have in common is belief. Skeptics, you say, are believers too. But you say this, you say believing in the power of science isn't actually doing science. That seems to be one of the things that kind of rankles you. Does that make sense?
I wrote it, so of course I think it makes sense. One of the great frustrations for me is that the skeptics a lot of times will deal with topics from the comfort of their armchair. And one of the stories in the book is about a UFO sighting in Stephenville, Texas in 2008, which was corroborated by radar data and showed that something was in the sky in the same direction as, you know, the witnesses were looking, at the same time as the witnesses were looking there. And I don't think we should run from that. You know, so something was there. One of the leading, or a bunch, I should say, really, of the leading skeptics have fallen back on this theory that what the people there saw were flares. But, you know, when you actually listen to what the witnesses had to say, they saw a massive set of lights that moved in unison, that seemed to be connected, and therefore they felt one big craft that could hover or move at, you know, really blinding sorts of speeds, and that it was followed by Air Force jets, and that ultimately when it was rocketing off, these jets came in behind it and chased it, and that it itself made no noise, but when the jets came in, they were deafening. So you've got a real break there, right, between when the jets showed up and when this thing was there by itself. And somehow we're supposed to believe that, you know, this object that moved miles and miles across the sky, miles and miles across their field of vision, was flares. And it just doesn't fit to travel at that velocity, for that at that speed, stop and start again. It just doesn't work. But that's the skeptical explanation. And it, you know, it really falls on its face before it ever really gets out of the starting gate. And that one's really mysterious to me too, because there is a military base near where the signing happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I start thinking in terms of at least an experimental craft. And I think that, you know, so still terrestrial, right? Still somehow earthbound. I think that the reason the skeptics don't go there and instead resort to what to me is a far more outlandish theory, flares, is because that would give the witnesses some credibility. They wouldn't just be bumpkins. They wouldn't just be fools. And I think that ultimately skeptics expect UFO witnesses to be bumpkins and fools. And so the idea that they may have seen something of a higher grade of technology than we're used to seeing just doesn't work for a skeptic.
Back to the phones. Dennis is with us in Layton, Utah. Dennis, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. With your guest, I would agree with some things that truly neutral stance is understandable. With other things, I don't think so. For example, if we've shown that Kraken doesn't exist and many other cultural monsters that cultures have, then when somebody comes to me and talks about chupacabra, I think the default position should be non-belief, and I would argue a similar position with claims of a specific god. If we understand that we've thrown out literally thousands of gods that used to do things like lightning storms or raise the sun, then when somebody comes to me with a new or current specific god claim, you know, my position without evidence is should be non-belief and not a true agnostic middle ground. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Again, I have no problem with belief. I mean, the you know, including non-belief, that's a form of belief. And so, you know, if somebody comes to me and tells me there's a Kraken, I would also not believe them. But I would also know that I don't know. And And again, the difference between this, you know, the Kraken and the Creator God, as you know, as I understand it, if somebody told me they saw the Kraken, my mind would open up a little bit, just a little bit, right? I would still not believe, but I would want to hear them out, and I would want to see if there's any more evidence. And again, in the case of a God, you know, setting aside all claims of a particular God, millions and millions and millions of people have claimed this direct experience, and I get frustrated too with skeptics who want to equate, you know, belief in a creator to belief in a teacup floating around the moon or a flying spaghetti monster. That's a famous one that the skeptics advance. It's different.
We don't have much time to talk about this, Steve Volk, but let me ask you, there's this chapter in the book where you offer readers something kind of practical as a way of an experience. I'm not sure if it's a paranormal experience, but it's about lucid dreaming. About a minute and a half left. Can you say something about that finally?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think that the reason people are drawn into these topics a lot of the time is they want to have that sense of an experience of something other, yeah. You know, something beyond the purely physical. And lucid dreaming is great because it gives you that sort of space in your mind where in a dream, once you gain lucidity and you can make choices for yourself about what you're going to do, rather than just sort of react the way we do in a dream, you now have the world's best virtual reality theater in your head in order to experience whatever it is you want to experience. And in fact, I had a fabulous lucid dream last night in which I evaded a dog that morphed into a dinosaur and then went ahead and decided, you know what, I'm going to make you a dog again by petting you. And lo and behold, as soon as I started petting this vicious dinosaur, it became a cuddly dog. So I think the fact that we have this kind of capacity in and of ourselves is something worth exploring. And toward the end of the book, yeah, we barely brushed the surface here. But toward the end of the book, I get into lucid dreaming as a way for people to start exploring themselves and their consciousness. And maybe, yeah, the paranormal too.
Steve Volk. His book is called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. Joined us from a studio at Temple University in Philadelphia. Steve, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for everybody for calling in.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Matthew Martin, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.